one place. The prisoners were held in about half a dozen large cells wrapped in barbed wire, each named after an Al-Qaeda attack. Nairobi, USS Cole, etc. Interrogators occasionally tried to convert prisoners to Christianity. Every Afghan who passed through Bagram, whether as a prisoner, interpreter, or prison staff, became part of an ever-dense network, spreading testimony to family, village, and tribe about the Americans. At CIA headquarters, desperation, fear, groupthink, pseudoscience, and misplaced faith in aggression and the humiliation of enemy prisoners shaped the agency's detention and interrogation program as it grew. Forward in Afghanistan, managerial incompetence, stupidity, and cruelty were the more important factors. As Afghanistan looked more and more like a backwater without a significant Al-Qaeda presence, and as the invasion of Iraq beckoned, the CIA increasingly deployed rookies, lightly experienced officers, and officers with troubled records to Bagram, Kandahar, and the Omega bases. The agency's talent pool in the clandestine service was thin. Demographically, it looked like a barbell. A sizable cadre of experienced senior intelligence service and colonel-level officers toward the ends of their careers, and a sizable influx of rookies inducted in a massive surge after 2001. Generally, the CIA's A-team now deployed to Iraq, the wider Middle East, and Pakistan, some officers working on Afghanistan concluded. The B-team too often went to Afghanistan, they believed. Rich Blee's successor as Kabul station chief, who took charge in the summer of 2002, oversaw the construction of a new CIA prison on the 10-acre grounds of a former brick factory north of Kabul, which became known as the Salt Pit. It opened in September. The windows were blacked out, and detainees were kept in total darkness. Investigators with access to classified CIA cables from this period reported. The guards monitored detainees using headlamps, and loud music was played constantly. While in their cells, detainees were shackled to the wall and given buckets for human waste. The new station chief's tour proved to be a disaster in the estimation of some senior colleagues. He stopped counseling Karzai on the grounds that the interim leader was irrelevant compared with the warlords. He assigned a junior officer on his first assignment overseas to supervise the agency's prison. To be sure, the station chief had little to choose from but first-timers by this point. The junior officer's career was off to a troubled start. He has issues with judgment and maturity, and his potential behavior in the field is also worrisome, a supervisor wrote. In November, Bruce Jessen, the former SEER psychologist, visited Afghanistan and assisted the inexperienced CIA warden in an interrogation of an Afghan suspected of extremism named Gul Rahman. The prisoner endured 2 days of sleep deprivation, auditory overload, total darkness, isolation, a cold shower, and rough treatment, according to a CIA cable. Jessen later admitted to slapping Rahman once to assess his reactions, but denied that he had been involved in more abusive action. He blamed the professional CIA officer and his guards at the prison facility for using unauthorized rough techniques. Jessen was working for the CIA. The guy that is doing these things is a CIA officer with whom he now worked at the site. A few days after Jessen departed, noting that Rahman was being held in deplorable conditions, the junior CIA warden and chief of base, who has never been formally identified, ordered Gul Rahman shackled in a position that left him on a cold concrete floor in only a sweatshirt. The Afghan died overnight, probably of hypothermia. After that shocking death, Jose Rodriguez directed the Counter-Terrorist Center's Renditions Group to take charge of the detention and interrogation program. As Senate investigators later pointed out, however, many of the same individuals within the CIA remained key figures in the program and received no reprimand or sanction for Rahman's death. In Virginia, the targeting analysts at Alex Station, including several of the analysts whose warnings had been overlooked before September 11th, urged the use of harsh techniques on Al-Qaeda suspects. They pressed colleagues in cables, attended interrogations in person, and urged harsh measures even when CIA wardens felt it had become inhumane or useless to continue. The analysts, said Alec, appear to have exercised an unusual kind of moral influence on the interrogation program at the CIA. Having issued warnings before September 11th, they now insisted again, with higher credibility, that anyone who opposed their willingness to brutalize al-Qaeda detainees for insight into the next attack could wind up with blood on their hands. The effect of harsh interrogations on Afghanistan's post-Taliban environment received hardly any formal analysis. In fact, by late 2002 and early 2003, the CIA's senior leaders, including those at the Counterterrorist Center, had stopped paying much attention to Afghanistan at all. That winter, CIA Inspector General John Helgerson, a career analyst who regarded the detention and interrogation program as unsound, opened an investigation that would play a significant role in documenting the program's abuses and setting the stage for its demise. Tenet told Helgerson he was not very familiar with what the CIA was doing in Afghanistan or with medium-value prisoners in general, a category assigned to many Afghan detainees. General Counsel Scott Mueller said he had no idea who is responsible for the Salt Pits detention site. Jose Rodriguez told Helgerson he did not focus on it because he had other higher priorities. Yet the Senate's investigation found that at least several dozen of the CIA prisoners subjected to enhanced interrogation techniques experienced them in Afghanistan. The same harsh CIA interrogation practices could be applied to agency prisoners held at Kandahar and the Omega fire bases along the Pakistan border. In early December 2002, immediately after Gul Rahman's death, George Tenet sent a formal message to all CIA stations and bases. When CIA officers are involved in interrogation of a detainee, the conduct of such interrogation should not encompass any physiological aspects. For example, direct physical contact, unusual mental duress, unusual physical restraints, or deliberate environmental deprivation beyond those reasonably required to ensure the safety and security of our officers and to prevent the escape of the detainee without prior and specific headquarters advice. The last phrase referred to the bureaucratization of the enhanced interrogation techniques. Yet even after this order, CIA officers could strip a prisoner naked, keep him in a stress position for 72 hours, and douse him with cold water repeatedly without prior approval, if such approval was not feasible. In practice, such abuse continued without significant review. At Asadabad, the CIA's David Pissarro had every reason to believe that his aggression toward Abdul Wali was consistent with agency norms in Kabul. Pissarro would have passed through Bagram and seen how detention operated there. In Afghanistan, an atmosphere of impunity and neglect evolved during 2003. That year, Kabul Station acknowledged, in a cable to headquarters, "We have made the unsettling discovery that we are holding a number of detainees about whom we know very little. The majority of these detainees have not been debriefed for months, and in some cases, for over a year." Certainly, Pissarro showed no qualms about allowing military guards and an Afghan interpreter to observe him as he pummeled Abdul Wali. Stephen Jones, the career officer who supervised Pissarro, sanctioned sleep deprivation at a minimum. On the evening after Abdul Wali was pucked, Jones wrote to his wife, "Our prisoner remains uncooperative, but we didn't let him sleep last night. We think it will take about 4 days before he wears down and starts to talk." After the beating he endured the first night, Abdul Wali gestured to his military guards, urging them to use their shotgun or pistols to kill him. Instead, on Pissarro's instructions, the guards kept the prisoner in the Iron Cross position, knees bent halfway, back against the wall, arms out. They instructed Abdul Wali through an interpreter that whenever he was ready to talk about what he really knew about the rocketing of the fireplace, he should say, "Dave, Dave, Dave," to summon his interrogator. Sergeant Kevin Gatton was on duty on the night of June 20th. When he came on shift, he said later, Abdul Wali had been 24 hours with no sleep, no food, little water, no breaks. He had some marks on him from the beatings, and he was acting delirious, knocking his head up against the wall, talking to his shoes. He gripped his abdomen, apparently in pain. After Gatton arrived, Abdul Wali called out through the interpreter, Dave, Dave, Dave. Are you sure you want him to come down? The guards asked. Pissarro drove up in a truck a little later, his lights on, in violation of the base's nighttime security protocols. Gatton was annoyed. It was typical of CIA to disregard discipline the military tried to enforce on their shared base. Pissarro climbed out holding a plastic cup of what smelled like bourbon or scotch. Under General Order No. 1, the U.S. military banned alcohol for American troops in Afghanistan. The CIA allowed booze on forward bases. At Assadabad, the agency kept beer, bourbon, and scotch. Hold this, Pissarro said, as he gave his drink to one of the sergeants. He gestured for Gatton to follow him into Abdul Wali's cell. Pissarro resumed his questioning. Who gave you your orders? Where are the weapons caches? I don't know, Abdul Wali answered repeatedly. Whenever he professed ignorance, Pissarro turned off his flashlight. Gatton couldn't see in the blackness, but he could hear smacks, like a body being hit, and then Abdul Wali groaning, crying, just making painful sounds. Why are you hitting me? Abdul Wali asked at one point. Don't be saying or doing anything, Pissarro answered. You don't know if I'm hitting you. The prisoner had a bag over his head. It could be my guard hitting you. It could be anybody. This upset Gatton further since, as he said later, I wasn't hitting him. The questioning and beating went on for about 90 minutes. Then Pissarro walked out and took back his plastic cup. Keep him stressed, he instructed. Make sure he doesn't sleep. Gatton returned to duty the next day, June 21st. Abdul Wali now looked like he had just gotten into a fight. His face was covered in bruises. He had bruises on his hands. He was staggering. The guy couldn't move. He just kept talking, not to us, just talking to himself, to the wall, to his shoes. Stephen Jones, the CIA base chief, was in the office when one of the men watching Abdul Wali turned up to say that Jones should take a look at the prisoner. Jones found Abdul Wali lying on his side, groaning. He looked white in color and obviously was in distress, Jones recalled. The base medics put him on oxygen and intravenous fluids, but Abdul Wali died an hour later. Major Mark Miller, the base's army commander, arrived soon after. He was very angry, as Jones put it. That afternoon they summoned Governor Akbar and his son Haider back to the firebase. They sat on the floor of a meeting room. Unfortunately, we have some bad news, Miller began. Unfortunately, Abdul Wali passed away. The governor shook his head. That's no good, he said in English. Pissarro described Abdul Wali's interrogation. He told the Afghans the prisoner had been fed power bars and had not been harmed. However, Pissarro continued, the prisoner had sometimes tried to break out of his shackles and hit his head against the wall. The Afghans inspected the body. Miller explained that his military superiors wanted to perform an autopsy. The governor insisted this would only compound the crisis because, to people in Kunar, an autopsy will merely serve as proof that the Americans are torturers. After some effort, Governor Akbar persuaded the Americans not to touch Abdul Wali further. The prisoner's family arrived to receive his corpse. The Americans gave them about $2,000. For their loss. Chapter 10. Mr. Big. By 2003, it was evident to many Afghans in Kabul that the Bush administration had turned its attention to Iraq and had handed the day-to-day management of their country's recovery to their native son, Zalmay Khalilzad, the unlikely Republican operative. In the White House, Khalilzad was seen as an immigrant success story and a regional specialist. In Kabul, he was understood as the product of his specific family and ethnic history. His father came from the east of the country, from a tribe of the Gilzai Federation, the less aristocratic of the two principal Pashtun tribal groupings. He had only an elementary school education and worked as a mid-level clerk for the provincial finance department in Mazar-i-Sharif. Zalmay was his eldest son. Around 1965, the family moved to Kabul. In high school, Zalmay entered the American Field Service Exchange Program, by which Afghan teenagers studied at an American high school for a year while living with a local family. He flew off to New York and rode across America in a bus, struggling to make himself understood in his limited English, marveling at wonders, massive highway bridges, ubiquitous electricity, the prevalence of television. In Modesto, he joined the Parra family of Ceres, California, in a region of the Central Valley known for the Gallo family's winery business. Later, Khalilzad enrolled at the American University of Beirut, under a U.S. Agency for International Development program designed to educate future leaders. At the University of Chicago, he earned a doctoral degree under Albert Wohlstetter, the influential nuclear war strategist who also mentored Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle, who would become prominent neoconservatives. During the Reagan administration, Khalilzad worked at the Pentagon on nuclear war planning. After a few years, he moved to the State Department to work on the Afghan War as well as Iran and Iraq. By now a committed Republican, Khalilzad spent the Clinton years in academia, business consulting, and think tanks. In December 2000, after the United States Supreme Court awarded the presidency to George W. Bush, Dick Cheney appointed him head of the transition team at the Pentagon. But Khalilzad and Donald Rumsfeld didn't get along. Condoleezza Rice found a refuge for him at the National Security Council. After September 11th, Khalilzad joined the bond negotiations that created the Karzai government as part of a broader plan of elections and the rewriting of the Afghan constitution. During 2002, he flew in and out of Kabul as a White House special envoy, to the chagrin of Ambassador Robert Finn, the Turkish linguist, who could not hope to compete with Khalilzad's influence among Afghan politicians or with his White House connections. Yet initially, Khalilzad's influence on post-Taliban Afghanistan was constrained. His NSC portfolio also included Iraq and Iran, which distracted him. The key issues in American policy toward Afghanistan, troop levels, reconstruction, outreach to Taliban defectors, burden-sharing with European allies, appeared to be settled by Rumsfeld's forceful advocacy of minimalism. Rumsfeld continued to believe that we did not go there to try to bring prosperity to every corner of Afghanistan. Such a goal would have amounted to a fool's errand. His skepticism won Bush's endorsement. Their convictions explained the parsimonious budgets and authorities Finn and David Sedney struggled with at the dusty, paraffin-fueled U.S. embassy in Kabul during 2002. By 2003, the political consequences of minimalism looked more and more disturbing, as Afghans wrote a new constitution that would bring presidential elections at the end of the following year. Hamid Karzai remained weak, certainly in comparison with Fahim, Dostum, Sharzai, Ismail Khan, and other strongmen backed by the CIA during the Taliban's overthrow. Karzai was only an interim leader at the Arg Palace, the chairman of a provisional administration, sharing rooms and influence with Zahir Shah upstairs, receiving ministers more powerful than he was. As Minister of Defense, Fahim controlled the Northern Alliance's well-armed militias, including the incipient Afghan National Army. It wasn't at all clear that Fahim or other generals would follow Karzai's orders if he issued them. Dostum, Sherzai, and Ismail Khan operated their own regional militias and maintained independent liaisons with the CIA. President Bush favored Karzai's continuation in office, Yet how could Karzai run for and mobilize votes for the presidency from such a position? In late April 2003, Rumsfeld flew into the capital and met Karzai on a Sunday in his office at the Ark Palace. Karzai said he needed U.S. bombers and special forces to force the strongmen around him to disarm their militias before any election. "Just hit them, and they'll all fall into line," was the essence of Karzai's message. Rumsfeld said he was not about to do that, but he did promise to think about the dilemmas Karzai outlined. When he returned to the Pentagon, Rumsfeld initiated a new planning exercise about Afghanistan. Around the same time, Bush asked to see Zalmay Khalilzad at the White House. Khalilzad had just lost a power struggle within the administration over how to manage Iraq after Saddam Hussein's overthrow. Khalilzad favored turning authority over to Iraqi politicians on an interim basis, as they wrote a new constitution, as had been done in Afghanistan. Bush decided instead to impose an American occupation government, the Coalition Provisional Authority, a decision that left Khalilzad sad and angry. As a salve, Bush now asked him to become the next U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. Khalilzad hesitated, but soon agreed. The Pentagon's new planning offered Khalilzad a means to develop a more ambitious U.S. policy for Afghanistan, one that might commit more heavily to strengthening Afghan institutions. The scale of the Coalition Provisional Authority and related reconstruction projects planned for Iraq in 2003, in the tens of billions of dollars, belied all previous declarations by Rumsfeld and Bush that they eschewed nation-building. Surely there could now be spared a billion or two more for Afghanistan, from which the September 11th attacks had actually originated. Afghanistan was also a vastly more impoverished country than lower-middle-income Iraq. Despite returning refugees, a relative peace, and some reconstruction work, Afghanistan remained among the three or four poorest countries in the world in 2003, alongside Somalia and Chad. With help from Rumsfeld's policy staff, Khalilzad built out a classified 30-slide PowerPoint deck titled Accelerating Success. He sold the plan to the White House and the Pentagon during May and June. It was the administration's first formal program to invest purposefully in the Afghan state. The draft proposed speeding the buildup of the Afghan National Army, breaking Fahim's grip on the Ministry of Defense to broaden the Army's ethnic and geographical base, and reforming the National Directorate of Security to diversify its ethnic makeup and make it more professional. The plan also contemplated the use of American arms to challenge Karzai's warlord rivals. Since the Taliban's fall, Rumsfeld had refused to allow American forces to fight for Karzai or any other Afghan leader in green-on-green or intramural conflicts. Now he relented, if tentatively. Khalilzad assured him and the cabinet that the warlords could be brought into peaceful politics primarily through pressure and negotiations, with only occasional shows of American force to back up the talks. The Deputies Committee at the National Security Council approved the plan on June 18th. The principals met 2 days later, with President Bush presiding. As Khalilzad clicked through his slides, Bush stopped him. "Zal, I want you to turn Karzai into a great politician," he said. The entreaty was typical of how Bush thought about Karzai. During their video calls, he tried to build up his counterpart by treating him as a fellow professional Pole. "You have your politics, I have mine," Bush would say when they struggled over divisive problems like Pakistan or civilian casualties. The president signed off on a final memorandum a few days later. The Accelerating Success PowerPoint deck became an action plan with tasks parceled out to cabinet departments. That August, Condoleezza Rice approved the formation of an interagency body, the Afghan Interagency Operations Group, to follow through. An Army colonel, Tony Harriman, arrived from the Pentagon to run the effort at the NSC. from offices at the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. Harriman discovered that the new White House plan for Afghanistan was better understood as a plan to write plans. What's our plan to reform the judiciary? What's our plan to deal with people who had been captured on the field of battle? Our reconciliation plan? How would they build up the army and reform the Ministry of Defense and professionalize the Afghan spy service under Engineer Arif? The operations group reviewed that autumn whether plans were complete or not complete. The problem was, as Harriman put it, they were all not done. In early October, Major General David Barno, a West Point graduate, landed at Bagram Airfield to assume command of International Conventional Forces in Afghanistan, which then numbered about 12,000. Barno was appalled at the lack of organization and planning he inherited. He was allowed by the Pentagon to travel with half a dozen staff, but had no headquarters team befitting such a large and dispersed force. Pentagon planners were so overwhelmed by the Iraq invasion, an initial occupation, that they seemed to manage Afghanistan from pieces of scrap paper. In his 15 years of senior command, Barno had never seen a poorer transition from one general to the next. He found it completely ad hoc and discovered there was not a campaign plan. Indeed, not a plan, period. Khalilzad had his PowerPoint slides and a signed presidential memorandum, but he was not one to be controlled by paperwork. He had secured what he needed from Washington, a new Bush-endorsed policy that promised bigger budgets and access to American troops to reinforce Hamid Karzai's authority. As a special envoy, Khalilzad had already established himself in Afghanistan as an improviser and local string puller. He would now become the most unconventional of ambassadors, less a diplomat than a kind of Afghan-American warlord, advertising benign intentions, wearing a smile and a suit. On November 27, 2003, Thanksgiving Day, a convoy of American armed guards and diplomats packed into sport utility vehicles roared through Kabul toward the airport. One SUV struck a pedestrian, a woman fully covered in a burqa. She fell. It wasn't clear how badly she might have been injured. The vehicles rolled on. The U.S. Embassy's security protocols for Afghanistan forbade drivers from stopping for an accident, at least in some circumstances. There were about 5,000 international peacekeepers in Kabul, yet the city remained insecure. If Americans attended to accidents, crowds might gather and grow excited, security planners feared. Security constraints shaped the lives of American diplomats and aid workers in Kabul. They endured long days inside heavily guarded buildings, forbidden from making spontaneous trips to markets or restaurants, their confinement relieved only by occasional outings in armed convoys, journeys that could be wondrous and terrifying in the space of a few hours. For Kay McGowan, a young embassy staffer in the convoy to the airport that Thanksgiving Day, who witnessed the collision with the anonymous Afghan woman, it was a heart-stopping way to begin what was to be a memorable day of VIP duty. The convoy was headed to receive Hillary Clinton, a champion of women's rights in Afghanistan, who was completing her first year in office as a United States senator. Clinton deplaned that morning with Jack Reed, a West Point graduate who served with her on the Senate Armed Services Committee. The pair was making a lightning tour of Afghanistan and Iraq, Clinton's first battlefield tour as a senator. They had chosen to spend Thanksgiving with troops from the 10th Mountain Division, which was based at Fort Drum, New York. Already it was apparent that Clinton might run for president eventually. She had just published a best-selling memoir, Living History, and the crowds that turned out for her book tour signaled her rise as a celebrity. Bush faced re-election in just a year. The Iraq War was deteriorating by the month. Democratic leaders saw an opening to argue that Bush had neglected Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda and had failed to plan adequately for the invasion of Iraq. It was the first draft of a democratic electoral strategy that would commit the party's candidates to the cause of Afghan security and development during the next two presidential cycles. Between Turkey helpings and photos with soldiers, Clinton affirmed that she favored sending more Western soldiers to Afghanistan to prevent the Taliban's revival. She referred to American interests in the country much as the Bush administration did. Afghanistan was a frontline state in the war on terrorism. The Taliban were hardened terrorists. The U.S. is resolved to stand as a strong partner and to ensure that the terrorists, whoever they are, wherever they come from, will be dealt with, she told reporters. The message should be, the Taliban terrorists are fighting a losing battle. Zalmay Khalilzad flew into Kabul the same day aboard a U.S. military C-17 transport jet to take up his post at the U.S. Embassy. He sat strapped in the cargo hold beside a demining tractor and 30,000 pounds of ammunition. At Bagram, he hustled onto a helicopter and landed outside the embassy. Khalilzad talked with Clinton and Reed, and then accompanied them to the ARG. They talked with Karzai about Pakistan and the Taliban's resilience. Clinton would become an ally of Khalilzad's across the aisle as he sought budget increases for Afghan aid. Khalilzad moved into a metal rambler on the embassy grounds, a kind of imitation house made of three trailers fitted together in an H-shape. His corrugated home was not far from where he had attended high school. Generators and prefabricated buildings had eased some of the primitive conditions embassy staff had known early in 2002, but the embassy complex remained lightly resourced, reflecting White House policy and Office of Management and Budget priorities. Not least to avoid spending long hours in his trailers, Khalilzad ingratiated himself at the Ark Palace and quickly became Hamid Karzai's chief wazir in residence. They had known each other since the anti-Soviet war, when Khalilzad visited Peshawar during the Reagan and Bush administrations, and Karzai served as a political advisor. The pair spoke in a rapid-fire patois of Dari, Pashto, and English, sometimes dropping words from all three languages into a single sentence. That ensured they could maintain a two-way conversation that usually only a few other Afghans in the room could comprehend. Khalilzad visited Karzai two or three times every day. He had dinner with him often. He helped Karzai prepare talking points for meetings with other ambassadors. They seemed to U.S. embassy staffers to get along like brothers, intimate, but capable of intense squabbling. In Khalilzad's opinion, the squabbles always ended cordially because I would explain what the facts are. We had a lot of information. He had a lot of rumors. And he had enough confidence to say, well, you are not gaming me. There was a sense that winter that the Bush administration had abandoned us, but we get to do what we want, as McGowan, Khalilzad's chief of staff, put it. Khalilzad invented American policy from day to day during the long hours he spent huddling with Karzai, chattering in their patois. None of us really knew what he was doing because we didn't have the language, McGowan said. DynCorp International, a military security contractor headquartered in Virginia, supplied bodyguards to both Karzai and the U.S. Embassy during this period. The two teams assigned to keep Karzai and Khalilzad alive fell into a strange rivalry, arguing about which principal had the higher Al-Qaeda or Taliban bounty on his head. Aware of the matter of appearances, Karzai accepted his bodyguard of burly men wearing wraparound sunglasses after consultation with Afghans from the provinces. At the ceremonial opening of a road project, a DynCorp guard punched out Karzai's Minister of Transport because he did not recognize him and feared he might be rushing Karzai. To combat Karzai's palace fever, Khalilzad and his staff scheduled as many ribbon cuttings out of Kabul as they could, partly because DynCorp would agree that it was safe for Karzai to travel only if the destination was an American-run event. Khalilzad attended cabinet meetings as if he were a member of his government, which, in effect, he was. A few days after an Afghan cabinet debate, the ambassador would read top-secret CIA cables reporting on what had transpired, based on reports from paid agents inside the Karzai administration. Reading the intelligence cables at his embassy desk, Khalilzad would snort, "That is not what so-and-so said. That is not what happened." Soon after Khalilzad arrived, Karzai asked him to help him remove Engineer Arif as chief of the Afghan spy service. From Karzai's perspective, the main problem involved ethnic politics. To build his political base as the presidential election approached, Karzai needed support from diverse Pashtun tribal leaders. These leaders inevitably included some with histories of accommodation of the Taliban during the 1990s. Karzai encouraged Pashtun leaders to visit him in Kabul to talk about reconciliation and post-Taliban politics. NDS sometimes arrested, interrogated, and even beat up these prospective allies, suspecting them to be enemies of the state. Khalilzad sympathized with Karzai's complaints about the NDS. He knew as well that the CIA and the Afghan Ministry of Finance had found evidence of extensive corruption at the service. According to Arif, accusations of personal corruption against him are unfair, but there were some problems with organizational corruption because of the chaotic situation and the lack of supervision of NDS staff in the provinces. Arif did not speak English fluently and was not as sophisticated about international politics as some of his Panjshiri colleagues. But Khalilzad would have to go through the CIA if he wanted to make a change. After 2001, Arif built out intelligence liaisons with Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Australia, and others. Yet the CIA inevitably became his dominant partner. The agency supplied a stipend to NDS in the budgetary year of 2002 to 2003 of $6.5 million, as well as irregular support, in smaller amounts, for specific operations. Yet this was only a fifth of the annual funding Arif sought as he rebuilt NDS in every province. He argued with his CIA advisors. He wanted to build a hospital for NDS employees, for example, because Afghanistan lacked a formal health system of any quality. The CIA pressed him instead to consolidate NDS's huge directorates. Karzai had appointed Ashraf Ghani, a former World Bank official with a doctorate in anthropology from Colombia, as his Minister of Finance. Ghani happened as well to be an old acquaintance of Zalmay Khalilzad's. They had played basketball in Kabul as teenagers, and had even been in the same cohort of the American Field Service Exchange Program, traveling together from Kabul to America. Ghani stayed with a family in Oregon. With Khalilzad's encouragement, Ghani tried to strengthen and normalize the central government by assembling Afghan technocrats around him, and allocating budgets and finance from his ministry, as other countries did. Engineer Arif fell into Ghani's crosshairs. At the end of 2003, the Ministry of Finance withheld salaries for 15,000 NDS employees for three consecutive months. The freeze jeopardized Arif's credibility with his own men. Arif could tap Fahim from time to time for funds from the old Northern Alliance coffers, but it was becoming clear to both the CIA and Karzai that Arif was using the NDS for the benefit of his own ethnic and personal interests, often working behind the scenes against Karzai and the government, as the CIA's Gary Schroen put it. Yet the CIA station chief in Kabul that winter opposed firing Arif. Panjshiri gunmen still protected expatriate CIA officers at the Ariana Hotel. It would not be wise to alienate them by removing their boss. And Arif cooperated well with CIA militia operations at the joint CIA and Special Forces Omega bases along the Pakistan border. Arif recruited, vetted, and dispatched fighters to serve in the reconnaissance forces. The station chief asked George Tenet to telephone Khalilzad at the embassy one evening to wave him off the plan to fire Arif. The ambassador stood firm, but Khalilzad and Karzai soon came up with a compromise they thought the CIA might accept. Karzai would appoint Amrullah Saleh as Arif's successor as the country's top spy. The clean-shaven, well-dressed Panjshiri occasionally interpreted during meetings at the Arg Palace. He was professional and had strong language skills. Khalilzad invited him to the embassy. Saleh came across as intelligent and self-taught, a man who had lifted himself up through work and merit. He seemed to be a genuine Afghan nationalist, not a regional chauvinist. He was eager to take full charge of NDS. Finally, the CIA relented. In February, Karzai summoned Arif and told him that he was promoting him to Senior Intelligence Advisor. By offering him an advisory role, the departing chief's wealth would not be threatened, and he would be eligible for other offices. He later became an Afghan senator. Arif had lost confidence in Karzai and believed that the interim president's advisors were spreading false accusations against him. For his part, Amrullah Saleh understood he had the CIA's backing, but he also grasped why Karzai might have endorsed his appointment. He was almost a decade younger than Arif. They thought, let us put the youngest and least experienced of them, meaning the Panjshiris, in charge, so that there is internal fighting between them. Saleh did seek to run NDS on more modern principles. When he took office, he claimed to have identified and fired 38,000 ghost employees in 1 week. At his Kabul headquarters, he built up an organization chart very similar to the CIA's. He separated analysis from operations and produced regular intelligence papers and threat and analysis briefings for President Karzai. Even under Saleh's reform drive, NDS remained too large, unruly, and penetrated by Iran and Russia to be a fully reliable partner in the most sensitive CIA operations along the Pakistan border. Saleh believed that there were massive flaws in the American approach to Afghan intelligence and security. The Bush administration starved NDS of the capital it needed to preempt Pakistani mischief and the Taliban's revival, he argued. $15 million a year was nowhere near enough for an agency combining the functions of the CIA and the FBI in a country so sprawling and vulnerable to guerrilla incursions across an open 1,400-mile border with Pakistan. Why does Afghanistan need a big organization? His CIA counterparts argued. Let's bring it down to a couple of thousand collectors. The agency's mission was to locate, kill, or capture al-Qaeda leaders. Saleh's mission was to stabilize a war-scarred, impoverished, and unstable country. The CIA would argue with me over small issues, how many vehicles to buy. It would be several years before they accepted his argument that defeating al-Qaeda and other transnational jihadists in the long run required much larger Afghan security forces. The NDS example illustrated American investment in post-Taliban Afghanistan. Deliberate minimalism, followed by tentative engagement, followed by massive investments, only when it was very late to make a difference. General David Barno, the commander of conventional forces in Afghanistan, kept an office at the embassy and lived 50 feet from Khalilzad in the compound's trailer park. Khalilzad and his aides regarded Barno as an effective, politically aware general. In fact, for the first time since the Taliban's fall, the ambassador, the military's commander, and the CIA station were unified around a political agenda for Afghanistan, however quixotic it might look. To advance Afghan governance, to deliver visible reconstruction projects that would benefit Karzai's prestige, such as an asphalt ring road around Afghanistan, and to strengthen his government's control over the budget. At the heart of all these policies was a single bet, implicit in the accelerating success plan, to place Afghanistan's leadership in the hands of Hamid Karzai, and to help him win election as president for a 5-year term. American policy under Khalilzad treaded a fine line. The United States would not interfere with or fix the eventual voting results, but it would prepare the ground for Karzai's candidacy by strengthening his writ in comparison with potential regional rivals. The goal was to move warlords into being political figures, as Barno put it, so that they would no longer resort to violence, but would become part of the fabric of government.
"What do you want to do, Mr. President?" Khalilzad asked Karzai, referring to the likes of Fahim, Dostum, and Ismail Khan.
Those three warlords controlled tens of thousands of armed men between them across the vast swath of Afghanistan's north and west.
"They won't listen to me," Karzai said. "They will listen to you."
Their first target was Abdul Rashid Dostum. In 2004, street protests and other agitation erupted against a Karzai-appointed governor in Faryab province. Dostum claimed that he was not in control of the protesters, but wanted their concerns addressed. Karzai dispatched an Afghan National Army unit to restore order. The ANA unit had American trainers with it, and Khalilzad warned Dostum that if he attacked it, he would be going to war with the United States. Khalilzad then joined Karzai at the Arg Palace. Dostum had called Karzai to rant. Khalilzad listened as Dostum said,
"We all thought Khalilzad was good, but he is the worst."
Khalilzad called him again.
"You will cross a bridge from which there is no return," Khalilzad said.
Dostum slurred his words and seemed to be drunk.
"It will be worse than Vietnam. It will be worse than Iraq," he raged.
Barno ordered a B-1 bomber to fly over Dostum's house and break the sound barrier. After a few more threats, Dostum relented. The next target was Ismail Khan, the governor of Herat. After the CIA had helped to return him to power in the province, Khan had seized control of customs revenue from Afghanistan's border with Iran, restored a picturesque mini-emirate of marching bands and ceremonial palace patronage, and had then picked a fight with Amanullah Khan, a local Pashtun militia leader. Their skirmishes were the last straw, so far as Khalilzad was concerned. He asked General Barno to deploy helicopters to the American-controlled airbase at Shindand, near Herat. They agreed it would be best to remove both Ismail Khan and Amanullah Khan. Khalilzad called Amanullah to tell him he was sending a CIA plane and that he expected him to be on it. Khan cooperated. The ambassador then boarded a C-130 to Herat. Ismail Khan's ceremonial dancers greeted him. At one of the palaces of the emir, Khan's self-endowed title, Khalilzad asked to meet alone.
"I think the time has come for you to leave Herat," he said. "President Karzai is thinking of you becoming a minister."
"I would like to be Minister of Interior," Khan replied quickly.
Khalilzad said he didn't want to get into the details of which ministry. Ismail Khan ended up as Minister of Water and Energy. Karzai's most powerful rival remained Marshal Mohammed Fahim, the heir to Massoud's militias. Karzai's strategy was to hold his enemy close. Initially, he decided to invite Fahim onto his election ticket as first vice president to help pull in the Tajik vote. As 2004 passed and the election neared, however, Karzai wondered if he had made a mistake. He debated replacing Fahim with a less powerful Banshiri, Ahmad Zia Mahsoud, one of the deceased commander's brothers, who had no armed following. General Barno opposed the idea. He worried that if Fahim was knocked off the ticket, he might stage a coup d'etat. Khalilzad was more sympathetic to Karzai's thinking about a change. Barno felt that Khalilzad counseled Karzai fairly even-handedly on whether to dump Fahim, but eventually he kind of put his foot down in favor of taking the risk. Barno now organized a plan to break the news to Fahim in a way that might deter him from striking back violently against the Arg Palace. Quietly, Barno's command mobilized NATO units with anti-tank weapons and stationed them in front of compounds holding Fahim's armored units. "We were ready to prevent a coup from happening that day, very explicitly," Barno said.
In full uniform, Barno arrived at Fahim's residence to tell him that he was off the ticket. The marshal was unhappy, but accepting. He gave Barno an extemporaneous lecture on the United States Constitution. It was not only Zalmay Khalilzad's language and heritage that made him seem to Afghans like one of their own. He also had an entourage and kin network that looked familiar in the light of evolving post-Taliban Afghan politics. Khalilzad had at least two family members who held positions in the Karzai administration. A nephew, Wahid Monowar, served as an aide to Abdullah Abdullah, the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Another relative held a diplomatic post. Like the Karzais, the Khalilzads straddled Afghanistan and America. Some of the ambassador's relatives sought to mix politics and business to cash in on reconstruction contracts, just as the Karzais and other newly empowered Afghan families did. Lawrence Longy, an American businessman, first met Khaled Monowar, another nephew of Ambassador Khalilzad's, at a tennis club in suburban New Jersey. Monowar worked there. Longy was a member. A number of Khalilzad family members had settled around Livingston, New Jersey, including Zalmay's mother and his brother David, an investment banker. Khaled Monowar was a student at Seton Hall University. He had a receding hairline and an open face that bore a notable resemblance to his uncle's. After the September 11th attacks, he and Longy talked about going into business together. From early on, Longy regarded Zalmay Khalilzad as the silent partner in this enterprise. Khaled Monowar would ask him to set up meetings with U.S. government officials, with contacts provided to him by his uncle. Longy said he visited the White House to meet Khalilzad and Monowar. For his part, Khalilzad said later that he had a vague memory of Longy visiting him when he worked at the National Security Council before he became ambassador, but he said there were no meetings after he was assigned to Kabul. His nephew told him that Longy was his friend and was interested in Afghanistan. According to Khalilzad, he did not introduce Longy to anyone to get a contract or instruct anyone to give him a contract. Khaled Monowar's ambition put Khalilzad in an awkward position. He could not ban his American relatives from going into business. They were free to do as they pleased. Yet Khalilzad knew enough about Afghan ways of business to fear that Monowar would use his connection to him to try to win business, even if Khalilzad did not want him to do so. As Khalilzad described it, Monowar probably did try to trade on my name, but I never introduced him to anyone in the U.S. government or to help him get a contract. Never. When I heard that he was looking to do business in Afghanistan, I told my embassy assistant not to give anyone an appointment who was introduced by Khaled. In January 2003, Longy and Monowar incorporated Afghamco Inc. in Delaware, and soon formed a partnership with Michael Baker Corporation, a Pittsburgh-headquartered engineering firm with experience in construction projects abroad. Longy's account is different from Khalilzad's. According to him, there were three meetings with Zalmay Khalilzad before and after he became the Bush administration's ambassador to Afghanistan, and at these sessions, discussions took place regarding the award of possible construction projects in Afghanistan and Iraq, including one to revitalize a quarry at the Kabul airport, as well as pipeline and a major water resources project, according to a court document. At the meetings with Zalmay Khalilzad, however, no confirmation was given about specific contracts. The partners were not shy about advertising their connection to Zalmay Khalilzad when they presented their business plans. In the spring of 2003, Michael Baker developed a PowerPoint deck that included a slide titled, "Who is Afghamco?" One of the boxes underneath that question read, "Mr. K, Bush Administration, Afghan and Iraq." In later months, while trying to determine where to send a particular business proposal, the parties exchanged emails. In some of these emails, The ambassador was referred to as Mr. Big. As the pursuit of U.S. government contracts went on, Longhi later complained, he was shut out of meetings and correspondence. He eventually sued Khaled Monawar because he believed he had been denied money he was entitled. There is no evidence in the court documents that Khalilzad acted improperly. Still, the visibility of Khalilzad's family members in the Karzai government and in seeking contracts created an obvious problem of appearances. When American diplomats scolded the Karzai family, or Fahim Khan, or Engineer Arif for cronyism, or when the Americans called such family-connected contracting deals corruption, the Afghans on the receiving end of such lectures had reason to cast a jaundiced eye. Chapter 11. Ambassador versus Ambassador. In 2003 and 2004, Afghans witnessed remarkable political events. The adoption of a new constitution, mobilization for a presidential election, planning for a new parliament. Yet there were signs of trouble. Periodic insurgent attacks caused about 50 American casualties each year. Hamid Karzai and Amrullah Saleh became united in conviction that ISI was back in action, covertly deploying the Taliban to destabilize their fledgling government before it could consolidate. Zalmay Khalilzad heard again and again from Karzai about the dangers of ISI. He tried to intervene, despite resistance or indifference within the Bush administration. Rich Blee had rotated to Pakistan as CIA chief of station in Islamabad about the same time that Khalilzad arrived as ambassador. During 2004, Greg Vogel, the paramilitary officer who had traveled inside Afghanistan with Karzai, arrived as chief of Kabul station. He succeeded the officer who had opposed Engineer Arif's removal. Vogel worked with Khalilzad and Barno to shore up Karzai, taking advantage of the trusting relationship he enjoyed. In Blee, Vogel, and Khalilzad, the Bush administration had now sent forward three men with long and unsentimental experience of ISI's covert support for the Taliban, dating back to well before the September 11th attacks. The Joint Special Operations Command first collected concrete evidence of an organized Taliban revival early in 2004. The movement's Shura Council produced an internal circular or strategy document to coordinate a plan for revival of military operations. The document was the rough equivalent of the campaign plans American war commanders wrote to ensure that frontline colonels and majors had a common understanding of strategy. Khalilzad and many of his aides, who had access to intelligence reporting, were fully convinced that Musharraf had approved a policy of quiet support for the Taliban's comeback. Yet while they could point to circumstantial evidence, such as the fact that Taliban leaders were living openly in Pakistani cities without harassment, they lacked hard proof of active Directorate-S funding or training. Even so, Khalilzad believed it was obvious that the Pakistanis could do more to suppress the Taliban. In the Kabul embassy, the prevailing view was that the Pakistanis were in complete and public denial, as David Sedney, then the deputy chief of mission, put it. Pakistani counterparts repeatedly denied the very existence of the Quetta Shura, yet the United States knew from intelligence that they were there. All the Afghans knew they were there. All the Pakistanis knew they were there, for that matter. Still, in prolonged face-to-face meetings, Pakistanis at the highest levels said otherwise. General Barno, who had access to all of the intelligence reporting, took a judicious position about Pakistani complicity. He never saw evidence in any domain indicating that the Pakistanis were actively supporting the Taliban's comeback. He could see that they basically tolerated the Taliban in the tribal areas, but it was also obvious that the Pakistanis' ability to control these areas was negligible. There were long stretches of the Afghan-Pakistan border where the Pakistani military had no presence at all. Where border posts existed, they were often unoccupied or commanded by paramilitary frontier corps soldiers. These were locally recruited tribesmen who were often influenced by